welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com. It is the 1st of April 2014 and this is episode 181 of the podcast. Now today I have an interview with Charlie Gilkey, who has spent time as a logistics coordinator for the US Army as well as studying for his PhD in philosophy, which I think is awesome because he blends, that sort of practical side with the more philosophical side, and he has a fantastic business working with creatives and implementing business strategies for them at productiveflourishing.com. Now, I really enjoyed this interview and actually helped me change some of the things in my business. So I hope that some pennies will drop for you too. I'll be able to talk a bit more about how I'm changing my business later on. I'm still working through the details. Yeah, so what else has been happening? Thanks to those people who joined the Scrivener webinar live on the phone. Not amusingly at the time, but it's kind of funny in hindsight. We had so many people, over 2,000 people arrived on the phone at the same time and crashed the meeting site. And we actually, amusingly, we ended up trending with hash Scriv, which I just came up with on the fly to answer questions from Twitter, alongside the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which is quite hilarious. I seem to remember that my little brother played with them, must be 20 years ago now, so goodness knows what they're doing back in the Twitter trending charts. I'm sure those of you with children understand why. But anyway, we crashed the meeting site and eventually got back online, but with far fewer people. So it's fantastic that the topic is so popular, and we ended up re-recording the session for the replay because because of the crash, the recordings didn't work and wouldn't have been any good otherwise. So between me and Joseph, mainly Joseph, did a lot of work to create a fantastic free video. So it's over an hour long, and I thought I would share the replay URL in case you didn't even register for the webinar and you're interested. So you can get that at learnscrivenerfast.com/webinar-replay. And the course, if you're interested in the Learn Scrivener Fast course, you can find my link at thecreativepen.com/Scrivener. And I highly recommend the course. It's brilliant. I'm learning so much that's really useful. Industry news. I have just noticed, just like yesterday, I think it was, that Amazon is now asking for specific customer recommendations. And you never know when they're beta testing and whether you are one of the few or whether they've actually rolled this out. But I got an email that says, you know, something like, you know, what should people read after reading this book? And then I can recommend a book, and it also shows what other people have recommended. So it's almost like a human curated recommendation thing, which is a great idea, and one I will be using. I really want to get something on my JF Pen site with a sort of display of the books that I love, that I think readers of my books will enjoy. I've been talking to a great author called Leighton Green, who has a really good series, Dominic Gray series, starting with The Summoner. If you like my books, you'll like his, and vice versa. We're both sort of write dark things on the edge of thriller, on the edge of horror, on the edge of fantasy, some people might say, on the edge of religious fiction. We fall through all kinds of gaps. So we're both trying to come up with ways that we can come up with a name for our genre. We are struggling. If you can come up with a specific genre for my books, I'd love to know. But that's why I'm using the tagline thrillers on the edge for my fiction, because I really do feel on the edge of so many different things. And I'm going to write a post about this at some point. We all struggle with branding, let's face it. Anyway, so that was about the customer recommendations. I'm also still wrangling with Nook Press. So they opened up to the UK and I think some other European countries last week. And what was so crazy was I loaded my EPUBs, the same EPUB that just slightly modified to add in links to my other books, the same EPUB as loaded fine onto Kobo and loaded fine onto iBooks. I loaded onto Nook and it's crazy. It's got blue text and underlined and, all kinds of funny formatting. The fonts have gone weird. And I Googled this and there's quite a few people who say that the Nook Press EPUB platform is very, very sensitive to specific things. So because I have 9 individual books now, I decided not to wrangle my own EPUBs, and I'm using peopleperhour.com, which is brilliant, and you can get people there to bid on a job. So I just put up my 9 files and said I want someone to clean these up for me, and someone is doing that now for a very reasonable price. So even if you're a control freak like I am and you do most of your files through Scrivener, I have no wish to be hand coding my EPUBs. So I'm really pleased that I have someone to do that, and I need to stop doing everything myself. This is my other big realization after talking to Charlie, and so I'm really breaking down the tasks that I have in my life. So that's good. So I feel a bit more in control of my time. So I did get my 2,000 words in this morning, which I was pleased about. Coming up in the next couple of weeks, so by the time I do the next podcast, I will have been to London Book Fair, which is very exciting, and I basically have meetings every half an hour for 3 days, which for an introvert like me means I will be spending the weekend on my own in quiet in order to psych myself up for it. But I will be doing lots of videos. I'm meeting Holly Ward, HM Ward, who right now is probably the most famous indie on the planet with her romance novellas, 13 New York Times bestsellers. I'll also be hopefully meeting Hugh Howie at the Digital Minds Conference, Barbara Freethy, Bella Andre, and a whole load of British indies at various Alliance of Independent Author events. I'm also speaking. And a lot of things, since last London Book Fair, a lot of things have come out of the networking I did at last London Book Fair. And I mention it again, and I can't go into too many details, but again, I hope I'll be able to talk about it next time. I've got some exciting things around translations and about audio, and everything has sprung out directly from networking and meeting people at events in person, and therefore being more visible, so that when an opportunity comes up, they naturally think, oh, I remember that girl I met. She mentioned something about that. I once again, and actually there's a post on the blog at the moment about building community. Once again, I think that networking and community and working together is a great way to, I don't want to use the word market, but it is, it's all marketing, but essentially raise your head up and be first in line for opportunities. Let's call it that way. off the back of that, I am going to be at Thriller Fest in New York in July. I have actually bought my ticket. I have yet to buy my flights and hotel, but I've bought my ticket and I'm committing to Thriller Fest because it's a great networking place to be. So if you are going to Thriller Fest or you are in New York, there might be a possibility of a tweet up or something. But anyway, I will be at Thriller Fest in New York. On writing, I am in the last third of Day of the Vikings, which is most fun, and was at the British Library the other day researching the Lindisfarne Gospels, as well as some other things. So quite excited about that. It just, after Delirium, which has the themes of mental health and suicide, and, you know, it's a murder mystery with the backdrop of the horror of early psychiatry, I really needed to blow stuff up. So Day of the Vikings is meant to be a sort of palate cleanser so I could just have fun. And it has been fun. It still is fun. And I will be finished the draft before London Book Fair. And hopefully we'll have that out in, I'm wanting it to be out middle of May. And then Delirium will also be in the rewrites and will be out June, July. So yeah, that's quite exciting. I feel it's quite funny. I feel like I've got all this work backed up and, you know, I should be ready to put something out again and I'm not. So I feel like I definitely need to have something out before the middle of the year. Yes, and also thanks to those people who emailed me after the last show expressing interest in my business book for authors, which will be kind of like a mini MBA on the business of being a full-time author, using business language like suppliers and cash flow and, you know, because I have have a business consulting background. So I'm going for that. I expect that to be ready in the autumn as it's a really big undertaking. I think it will be a, you know, really big book. Well, it seems to be. Just brainstorming the table of contents, it's ridiculously large already. So we'll see. But I think that's important. And that will be my nonfiction project this year. Okay, so very excited to get on with the interview with Charlie. But in the meantime, the podcast is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life. And here is a short message from our sponsor.
Hi, Creative Pen listeners. This is Mark Lefebvre, Director of Self-Publishing and Author Relations for Kobo. What is Kobo? Kobo is a global e-book company born out of Canada. Kobo is available in 190 countries around the world. Now, authors like Joanna Penn already are taking full advantage of the fact that while there may be certain players, world's longest river, that exist and are quite prominent in a few nations, Kobo is available and continuing to expand and grow in territories around the world. And one of the wonderful things about being a Kobo Writing Life author is when you look at that dashboard and you see that you sold a book in some country that you probably haven't heard of before. Check us out at KoboWritingLife.com. And now back to your host, Joanna Penn.
Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com and today I'm here with Charlie Gilkey. Welcome, Charlie.
Hey, thanks for having me, John. I'm so excited to be here today.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. So just as an introduction, Charlie is the best-selling author of The Small Business Life Cycle, a guide to taking the right steps at the right time to grow your small business. His business at ProductiveFlourishing.com helps people with productivity and creativity, and Charlie is a champion and catalyst for creative giants, which is very exciting. So, Charlie, tell us a bit more about your background and the journey to where you are now.
Yeah, well, where I've gone or where I am now has been almost an accident in the sense of, like, you know, I'm now a business strategist. So people are like, you had it all figured out. I was like, I totally did not have this figured out. And so basically how this version of myself started with my professional career online is that I was simultaneously a Army Joint Force Military Logistics Coordinator. Basically, the Air Force were doing, you know, they had planes going, they had different operations going, and the Army had different operations going. I was the guy that planned and made sure that we were talking to each other and coordinating and executing on what we needed to do. So that was one part of my life. But the other part of my life was me as a graduate student in philosophy finishing up my PhD. And so I had this combination of worlds that didn't seem to mesh very well, not on the character side of things. That's what most people think, like a military officer and a philosopher, that seems weird. But just about how they approached the world to get things done was dramatically different. Incredibly pragmatic, incredibly strategic, incredibly thoughtful about organizations and team building on the military side versus unstructured, not really sure where you're going, very exploratory and, you know, resistant to teams, resistant to a lot of that stuff. And it was interesting for me because I saw that there was this helpful synthesis between them, that you can take the structure and the strategy and the emphasis on team building, service, and mission, and combine it with a thoughtful approach to one's work and deep level of mastery over one's profession and so on and so forth. Merge them and get a new synthesis that actually made one productive and made one, like, flourishing in their careers and in their life. So that's how Productive Flourishing started. It did not start necessarily as a business consultancy. And then as I got along, I would talk to people like you, and they'd be like, hey, I'm doing this thing. And they'd be like, well, where are you going with that? And you're like, well, I'm not sure how to get it done. I'm like, well, have we talked about this? Because I was just a natural sort of planner and strategist. And so that kind of came into, hey, will you help me grow my business, or help me like actually figure out how to put more business under this business? And so that's what I've been doing. I primarily, like I said, work with creative giants and really help them transition and thrive and do a lot of work on systems, strategy, and team building. So that's largely what I do and how I got here.
Yeah, and it's so awesome. And I'm going to come back on creative giants if people are like, oh, what's that? I'm going to come back to that. But I wanted to, when I was reading about your journey, it's kind of amazing because I have a master's in theology and you're in philosophy. And I was in like large corporates in the mining industry. And I was thinking of your logistics, like the mining industry. It's like all these big trucks and, you know, so very similar background. And I wondered about your thoughts. So the people listening are authors. A lot of them will be writing fiction, which is a kind of another thing altogether. How does your practical business experience in something like logistics help with creative work? And can you share any lessons learned with people listening?
Yeah, well, that's a great one because, you know, logistics is the art and science of getting people and stuff from here to there smoothly, safely, and in order, right? That's really what it is. Now, when it's in combat logistics, it's, you know, through combat and fire and things like that, but that's a whole nother thing. But at its core, it's getting stuff from here to there. All righty. At its core, writing books is getting ideas from here to there.
Yeah.
It's the same basic methodology. Starting a business is getting value, money, resources, so on, from here to there. And so when you really start looking at it, it's a flow of stuff from one direction to the other. And, you know, the study of logistics is basically the study of friction, meaning stuff gets stuck here and how to get it from unstuck there to over there, right? The flow, you know, studying business and business strategy is very similar. It's value is kept or concentrated here. How do you get it there? And how do you keep it going through a business in ways that make sense, right? So that's all very general, right? All very general stuff there. When it comes down to it, you and I may disagree on this one. We'll see. That will make it interesting. To be a thriving author, especially if you're going to be an independent author, it's really about throughput. Right. And you have to understand that it's about throughput because you don't have the luxury of the large distribution chains of a distribution of a traditional publisher. So you can't have one hit that goes, you can't plan for that. You might be that 0.1% of the authors that do that, but you have to look at it in terms of throughput. I got this idea. What's the smoothest way to get this idea into an actual structured book, whether it be nonfiction or fiction, to get that structured book into the market, to get that book into the market, into people's hands. And to get the feedback and the reviews and, you know, all the value that's on this side of the equation back into the business, back into the funnel so you can start it all over again. It's a value flow, just as, you know, picking up equipment from one fort and moving it to another fort, picking up equipment there and moving it back is a value flow the same way. So that's kind of one example that you can think about. It's really about throughput, and it's really about a continual prolificness as opposed to the fits and starts. But there's a myth we have around creativity that, like, you know, it's all fits and starts. Like, you'll have 3 days when you write the book, but then you'll have 9 months fallow. And we think that that's the way creativity happens. Not so much when you actually look at the literature, when you do the studies in cognitive psychology and you do the studies in practical creativity. That's not how it works for most successful and thriving authors.
I
said a lot there, so there we go.
No, I completely agree with you. That's basically the way that, certainly in fiction, people are making a living by writing a lot of books. But it's also, like you say, I mean, a lot of the business world, we have process flows, we have structures where things have to happen in an order. And I think that authors kind of forget that side of things. I also wanted to ask you about the philosophy, because we live in this kind of crazy, hyper-connected space where everything, and we're rushing around, and like you say, if we want more throughput and we have to work harder and blah blah blah. So as a philosopher, how do you take things up a level and look at the world in a kind of bigger picture way?
Mm-hmm. Well, before I jump to the philosopher thing, I don't necessarily think that focusing on throughput means you have to do more work. I think it just means you have to be more concentrated and focused about the work that you do, right? And so a lot of the bright and shiny objects that authors love to chase are something that you have to become more disciplined about. It's like, I've got four books in flow, right? There are different levels of flow. I'm going to work on one of those four books. I'm going to, like, I've got this thing that I need to do. So it's not necessarily that you do more. You just do more of the right things, right?
Yeah.
And that's where I want to tie in the philosopher bit is, you know, and this is reflected through both the Western and the Eastern traditions, that the end of all human actions is flourishing or happiness, right? That's really why we do what we do. And so when we think about that from an author's perspective or from a professional creative's perspective is, in what ways are you cultivating happiness or flourishing in yourself, in your community, in your business community, and in the world at large? And is the work that you're producing doing that? You know, so if you're a fiction writer, you deliver delights, right? It's entertainment. There might be some social commentary, might be some things like that, right, that are add to it. But those should solve people's problems. Well, not on the fiction side. That's on the nonfiction side. On the nonfiction side, you're basically, you know, looking for aesthetic value. You're adding aesthetic value to the world, making people happier that way. On the nonfiction side, you're either solving problems, delivering delights, or helping people do what they're trying to do, all which lead to happiness in a different way. So that's what I really look at when we come down to it, is at the end of the day, right, we can get caught up in the crunchy bits and the tactics and the techniques, but are the actions that we're doing today leading to personal, community, social, and then global sort of happiness in some demonstrable way? And I know I get this one a lot, right, because I'm a little bit younger than people would assume I am, right? And so they're like, that whole change the world thing, like, that's great when you're young, right? But you get kind of jaded as you get older. And it's like, not so much, right? Because that little molecule of water falling over the rock, that doesn't make much change. But when you have a whole river of molecules falling over a rock, it carves the Grand Canyon, it carves some of the beautiful things that we do. So every step that we do in small ways changes the world. And most of the time, the big changes that we see started with small changes. So that's what I'd be looking at, is how are the small changes that you're looking for really cultivating that sort of global flourishing and thriving that I was just mentioning?
Wow, there's so many places I could go with that. But I want to step up then to, you know, somebody comes to you and they're, okay, so me right now, I'm right at this point of going, I really need some help. You know, I'm like, I'm not spending enough time, like you say, doing the things that make me happiest. So when people are looking at how do, you know, but there are things we have to do anyway. So do you advise people on outsourcing, and, you know, do you have any recommendations around sort of finding the ways to remove the things you don't want to do in your life?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll say this before I go any further. Eliminate before you delegate. And I see so many people that are like, there's this thing I don't want to do, so I'm going to outsource it. And it's like, does it need to be done in the first place? Like, yeah. Don't pay for something that's not adding value. So there are things that when you look at the value flow in your company or the value flow in your career, they're just not adding value. You know, I'll pick on social media because I love picking on social media, right? If you're spending hours and hours and hours on, say, LinkedIn, and there's just no traffic coming back to it, like there's no engagement, there's nothing happening on LinkedIn. Well, you know, in a perfect world, you might be able to do everything, but in this world, you're only able to do that much. So stop doing that, right? And I know that there's all the pundits saying that LinkedIn is great and this is great. It's great for somebody. It might not be great for you. So that's where you really take a valued perspective and say, you know what? That's a lot of activity I'm doing that's not generating value. I'm going to stop that. But here's the thing, though, and it cracks me up. The things that a lot of times provide the most value, the LEHI, low effort, high impact, are the things we overlook or don't want to do more of, right? And it's fantastic because it's like, I was talking to a client about, about this last week, and she was like, okay, so I'm trying to sell more of this program. And I've been building these online relationships for like 18 months and, you know, trying to figure out these joint venture partnerships, so on and so forth. And so that was one part of the story she told earlier. And then she said, like, yeah, I had the speaking thing last night. And, you know, I just kind of fell in my lap and I'm turning them away. But I sold 12 of these programs. And I'm like, okay, so you do this thing that you actually enjoy doing. She loved doing the speaking, right? She loved being there with people. That's selling the product she's trying to sell. at the same time that she's been working 18 months over here to not have a partnership that's not doing any. So I'm like, why are you doing it the hard way? Because that's the hard way, clearly. This is the easy way. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with the easy way? And so that's what I would say to really look at as far as value flow in your business. What are the low effort, high impact things that you can do, and do more of those, right? Because whether we're talking about life or business, the name of the game is do more of what works and less of what doesn't, right? And I know that's very simple, but it's hard when you take a sentence like, you know what, that's working. I'm going to do more than that, more of that. That's not working. I'm not going to do more of that. And then as far as outsourcing goes, and this is really important for creative work and authors as well, is there's like what I call a core task and satellite task. Core task, satellite task. You actually getting the ideas from your head to some type of screen or audio recording, that's a core task. No one else can do that. Mm. There are a lot of people who can edit that. There are a lot of people who can take a narration and transcribe it and edit that and coax that into something. There are a lot of people that can take your book and market it for you. There are a lot of people that can take your book, format it, put it on Amazon for you, right? There are a lot of people that can do those satellite tasks, but there's only one person that can do the core task. And so I think there's part of the problem, and I've experienced this with a lot of indie publishers, is that we're not really thinking of our business as a business. We're thinking of it still as a hobby in the sense that I'm going to do everything I can on my own to keep costs down. Hmm. And in business, there's what's called numerator management and denominator management, right? Numerator management is what you're doing to increase the value of your company, to increase the revenues of your companies, how you're going to grow your top line. Denominator management is how you're going to keep your expenses down. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we're so focused just on the expense that we're not saying, you know what? If I actually hired a ghostwriter, and by ghostwriter, I don't mean someone who writes for you, but someone who takes your words, like, you know, your transcription, and types them up and edits them. If I were to hire that, that would increase my book productivity by 2, right? Because it would take that much less time, which means I could put out the same quality of book twice as fast, which means I have twice as many people read, like, you know, wherever you push your books. That increases your productivity and your numerator in very phenomenal ways. And to be transparent here, I figured this out last year because I had a lot of stuck around the fact that, like, I should do my own writing. I'm a writer. I'm an author. And then I started thinking about it. I was like, you know, Aristotle, we only have Aristotle's works because his students actually transcribed his lessons, put them together, and collated them. When you go back and look at, you know, Paradise Lost, John Milton. Actually, he did not write that. His daughter, like, you know, was a scribe for that. So I was like, you know what? It's good enough for Aristotle and it's good enough for John Milton. Maybe I should give that a try. And that's the only reason my book actually exists is because I'm like, you know what? I need to get a book out there. I'm a natural talker. I'm a natural, like, I'll go to the board and I'll, like, explain things. So I figured out for me what I needed to do was create a PowerPoint presentation and actually talk out, because that allowed me to have the structural arc of a book, a beginning, finish, you know, beginning, middle, and end that made it the total coherent story. That was the hard part. The easy part was just talking it out and then giving it to an editor, then giving it to another editor, and then having it come back to me, make some tweaks, giving it to a book formatter, and then there. So that's how I got that book done. And that's how I'm probably going to do every other book in the future, because I recognize that, you know what, in an hour of me talking, I could crank out about 6,000 usable words, right? That's not all the stuff that ends up coming out, the ums, the chatters, the, oh, wait, I didn't mean that. When you look at especially self-published books, if you're thinking about independent publishing and the trend towards shorter books, it's really one of those things where in a couple of days you can get the entirety of your book out and get some other people working on it so you can work on other aspects of things. So that's one way you could outsource things and really think about what's the core task, what are the most effective and simple ways to get that core task done, and how can you hand it over to somebody else that can finish the rest of the product.
No, that's great. And that transcription model is, I recommend that all the time for nonfiction authors. I think it's a lot more difficult for fiction authors. I think it is. People are doing it now. So Terry Pratchett, who has Alzheimer's now, does everything by speaking, and he has an assistant who writes it all down. So it can be done.
Yeah, I've seen fiction writers do it, and the way they do it is they'll tell the broad story, Like, here's what's supposed to happen. And they'll chart through what the characters are doing, and this happens, and this happens, and this happens, and they get that transcribed. And then they'll come back and add the layer of aesthetic detail that makes it feel like a well-written novel. But you start with the basics of storytelling. And so many fiction books don't work because there's not a compelling story. There's not actually, like we don't invest in the characters. We don't do those types of things. And that happens at the story level, not at the technical level. The technical level you can come back and fill in later on, and it's a lot easier to do to describe a scene that you've already, like, you know, Joanna walks in the house and there's a cat that's yelling at her, and she notices that the cat is bloody, right? And so you're like, oh, well, this is going to be a mystery, right? Or something like that. I mean, you can go back in and describe the layers of detail that makes it feel more real after you've gotten it out of your head and decided that you like that story. So it works both ways. You just have to be more creative on the fiction side. But you know what? As a fiction writer, I'm a nonfiction writer mostly, so the creativity is not necessarily in the way the words hit the page so much as opposed to just finding novel ways to explain things to people. I'll say that I really appreciate fiction writers and the level of craft and creativity that they have to actually create a good book worth reading. So thank you for writing those books, because it's not my thing, but I do enjoy that you do it.
No, I mean, you know, I write nonfiction too, so it's great to have both. But I want to just, again, take, you know, you've got a lot of great business language, which I really appreciate. And that you mentioned strategy. And so again, if I come to you and I'm like, oh, I don't know, you know, what about my social media, blah, blah, blah. And then I imagine you would say something like, well, what is your overall strategy for the next however long? So, you know, maybe you could talk a bit about that. You know, if we lift our heads up and kind of go thinking about more of the long term, what are some of the aspects of strategy for business?
So it's goals. Well, above goals, it's, you know, sort of vision, mission, then goals, and then strategy. People forget those top three parts right there. Then tactics, right? And then priorities, and then things like that. So we kind of come into it most of the time backwards, in the sense of we're like, should I do this or that? Or is there a better way to do this? And well, the question should be, is that worth doing in the first place? How does that fit your goal? How does that get you closer to that? So a lot of times I see the first place I start is, well, you know, should I do this or that? I'll first say, what are your goals? I want to ask about your strategy, right? Because I need to talk about those goals. And you're like, well, my goal is to sell this book, right? Well, sell a lot of books is what you hear a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to sell a lot of books. Well, are we talking 2,000, 10,000, 20,000, 200,000? Like, what's really the goal here? Like, oh, well, I want to be a New York Times bestselling author. Okay, there's a certain way you go about doing that. Are you really going to invest in the way to do that? Does that fit your life? Does that put you in alignment? Is that realistic with the time that you have available? Right, because when you start with the goals, you can really get clear about what it's going to take to get there, and you can start formulating a strategy from that point. And a lot of people don't actually sit down and think about, you know, we creative giants, we can do just about anything, but we can't do everything. Right? And so really, goal setting and strategy making is about figuring out those things that you're not going to do and focusing on the things that you are going to do. And being very clear, because everything that you do displaces something else that you might have done. So if you choose the wrong goals, that displaces the right goals that would have been right for you. And so we would come back and say, okay, what are you trying to do here? Well, I want to write a book and I want to finish a book this year. Okay, well, we've got 9 months left. Then you start talking about resources. Well, how quickly do you write? What are your capabilities? How far are you along in the book? So you start to look at that current assessment of where they are versus where they're trying to go. And then that's where your strategy would come in and say, okay, given those constraints, where you're trying to go and where you are, here are some courses of action at the broad level that are going to get you there. So if you're thinking about social media, largely as authors, we think about social media as engagement and building an audience and platform to sell the book later on. But what we sometimes forget is that selling from social media is terrible. The conversion rates are abysmal. You would need to use social media to build a marketing channel for some other sales channel that you have, either your website or something else like that, right? So I see that we're not thinking about the role of social media in the right way. It's like, well, I'm going to get on social media and I'm going to sell more books. Well, there's about four steps in between you getting on social media and you selling a book that we really might want to think about here, right? And so that's largely the way that that would go. It's like, okay, your goal with social media, given this book, given it's a fiction book, it's going to go for, you know, women of this age bracket. So that lets us decide which social media channels we're going to go on. It's going to be a good for us having a social media plan for Pinterest, but not so much for LinkedIn, right? For different reasons, because we've already predetermined from our strategy and what we're going after. We've already predetermined a lot of those decisions that help us on the tactical side. And I think that's the value. And I'm a strategy geek, obviously. But the value of it is that a strategy is a set of decisions that you've already made about how you're going to do something, mm-hmm. right? That set of decisions keeps you from having to decide every day how you're going to do this. Should I do this? Should I do that? And there's so much decision fatigue that happens, not only at the business level, but also at the craft level. Am I going to take this story this way or that way? Am I going to write about this topic? And you can just get overwhelmed by decisions and information. Whereas a strategy will say, you know what? This book is for this person, this type of person. This type of person reads this type of stuff.
Yeah.
They are on these types of platforms. They like to be talked to in these types of ways. They like this type of book. All of those decisions are already made for you. So you just follow that script and you do it with a level of consistency and a level of focus such that you align your strategy and your execution in a smart way, as opposed to trying everything, hoping that it works. And not really being able to really invest and commit to one thing or two or three things that do that does actually work. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And just on a very high level, you know, when I was a business consultant, and when I made the decision about this career, you know, I've got on my wall, it's still here, I am an author. So every decision I made, like, I still had to go to my day job, but it was like going to Pizza Hut job or whatever. It was just a day job. I am an author means everything I do has to be about being an author. And another example with blogging, you know, should I go to South by Southwest? No, I'm a fiction author. I should go to Thriller Fest in New York instead. If I'm going to go to a convention, it should be with, or you know, fiction authors. So I totally get what you're saying. It's, you know, absolutely true. How do you figure that out on the philosopher stroke business strategy side?
How do I figure it out for me?
Yeah. Like, are you a philosopher? Are you, you know, what are you?
I'm an and person, so I'm all of those.
Uh-huh.
Right. Okay. And so I think there's that categorization that's useful, like when we're walking out in the world of like, oh, Joanna is an author and Charlie is a philosopher. Like, it's useful because it helps us sort of navigate the world without complexity. Mm. But the reality is we're and people, right? Mm. You're an author and a businesswoman and, you know, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it makes it more challenging in that sense, because I think more of this way. What can I do that's of service to other people that I enjoy, that I can do profitably, right? And in that nexus, right, is the sustaining. And that's not unique to me. That's Jim Collins. That's basically the business flywheel, if you've ever read Good to Great. It's saying the same basic things. There's got to be some service for me. I've got to be actually making a difference in the world, or I won't have the meaning and purpose that I want. Mm. And plus, it's a waste of time. I mean, there's so many better things that we can do than – anyways, I'll not go there.
Yeah.
And then there's what things – so there's service. There's joy. What can I do and have fun? What can I do and be happy? What can I wake up in the morning out of – like jumping out of bed saying, hey, I really enjoy doing this, right? And the third thing is what can I do profitably? Meaning I've got to put food on the table. There are other things that I want to do. Money is never intrinsically valuable, meaning money only gets you something else, right? And so there's a certain bit to where having more money coming in my business, one, allows me to get better support, and it allows me to pay for other people to do what they love to do. And I hire the people that love to do exactly what I need them to do with the business. Mm-hmm. So there's a spreading joy that way, but it also allows me to, give bigger gifts to the community through either charity, or I can use my time in a different way. I might decide this activity, I don't need it to be profitable, but it makes me happy and it's of service, so I'm going to go do it anyways. But that's only because I have other things that are providing the profit float. So that's generally what I look at, not so much of who I am, but what am I trying to do in the world, and what lights me up, so on and so forth, because I think who we are is flexible. And I think it's really comes down to, there are sometimes stories that we tell about who we are that's helpful, and then there are stories we tell about who we are that's not helpful. And so I don't know if that at all answers the question, but
yeah,
I try not
Sure.
Well, because, I mean, in my lifetime, I've been an Army military officer. I've been, you know, a philosopher. I've been a business advisor. I'll be other things as I go along. So it's not that I'm this, it's like I'm all of those things. This is the way I'm showing up now.
And so coming back on the creative giants, because you had this realization for your site, and I read the post all about it. So tell us a bit about, you know, what is a creative giant? Because it really resonated with me, you know, what you were saying.
Yeah. Okay. So a creative giant is a Renaissance person that they really are committed to. They see the world in a way that can be better. They see how the world can be better, but they are the people who actually take action to make it better, right? So there are a lot of dreamers, and creative giants are dreamers, but they're the dreamers that actually follow it up with action. And there's a third piece about them, though, is that they are incredibly talented. So they are the people who are actually capable of changing the world. So there are people who dream, who don't do. There are people who dream and do, but aren't really capable. Creative giants are all three of those. And normally they're really talented in an industry. They're either like smarter than the average bear, or they've spent more time in it, or they picked up something. They've had a, you know, they've been doing it longer, but they're just really talented people that stand out. Now, they're not always extroverts. So sometimes they're really, really quiet, right? And you don't necessarily notice that they're over there until you start talking to them about their thing. And then you're like, oh, wow, that's a whole world of information and fun over there that I did not know about. And so it's compassion, that's the drive to make the world better. Talent, which can be, you know, capabilities or just affinities. But then there's that actual conviction and commitment to actually do it that make up really the nexus of a creative giant. But it's also what causes a lot of the challenges, because they're incredibly powerful, but they're compassionate, so they don't want to, like, you know, impose on people with what they're doing, and so they kind of play smaller, or they don't want to stand out too much because the people around them like feel less than, or then they get put on a pedestal. So there's all sorts of weird dynamics that happen when you have those three traits put together at the same time.
And then I was reading, there was also a thing about, I've got it here, they crave simplicity at the same time that they reject it. Which I thought was great, and I felt like the term giant, you know, why do we resist terms like giant, or is that just me being British and Americans are quite happy for it?
No, it's not you being British. I think one of it is that there, well, in the United States, and I'm sure this holds for British people too, that there's such a degree of sort of a democratic understanding of like we're all equal, like we're all equally capable. We're not, though. I mean, that's the thing, is that we're not. And it's hard, really, for some people to really get to the grips and say, you know what? I am a phenomenal writer. I always have been, and that's what I am. And so, like, other people will send to me, and it's crap. It's rubbish, right? It's not at the level of standard. But when I do it, it's great. And so I think there's that understanding that you can be – it's confidence that we don't really want to claim, because again, part of the nexus. Okay, so I'll go philosopher real quick. Things like compassion is actually a thick moral trait, right? So it includes other things like humility, and so we pack in a lot of things like that. And so it seems to be compassionate that you got to be humble, and to call yourself a giant is not being humble.
Yeah.
So you can't call yourself a giant and be compassionate, right? By sort of logical transference, but that's not true. When you look at, you know, creative giants in the world, Mother Teresa, the Dalai Lama, right? Martin Luther King, other, they were giants in and of themselves. And you have to understand at a certain point that when you've got a mission and you've got the talent and you really have the conviction to do it, you are going to stand out. There's nothing that you can do about that. That's one of the reasons it makes you a giant. And one of the reasons we don't like being giants is because we stand out. The spotlight's on us. It puts the performance on us. Are we going to be able to do it again? Do I want to do this every day? Wait a second, don't pigeonhole me. I want to do something else. What if I start something and it's the wrong thing? And then 3 years later, I want to do something different. And then, like, all of those things come up, but we don't realize that we live in what I like to call project world, right? Mm. And project world is just the idea that careers and everything are really broken down into 3 to 5 year chunks, right? You've got a project, write this book, build this platform. And we can't see out further than that anyways. We think we can, but we really can't, right? And so really what you have to ask is, for this particular project, for this aspect of myself, and you heard me say that earlier, here's how I'm showing up now, right? 5 years from now, I might show up as a politician. 5 years from now, I might show up as some other version of myself, because that's the project that I'm in. That's the phase of my life that I'm in. So in project world, you have to really understand that where you're going to be in 5 to 10 years, you can't see. But what you can see is, based upon your values now, based upon the joy, profit, you know, those things that I talked about, here's what makes sense to do now and to commit to for this amount of vision. And then once you reach there, reassess, constant reassessment, because something might come along that you never imagined, right? So you write the book and you just sort of doing your thing, and you have this hit that takes off. You love it, the audience love it, the market love it, the media love it. That might change your career trajectory incredibly. And if you've decided, no, I'm just doing this thing, and this happens, and you just don't pursue it, I think that's a resistance to sort of the abundance that the universe would provide, right? And so it's one of those things that we sit around a lot of times, not everybody, right? So Joanna's awesome, so she doesn't do this, but we sit around like wishing for good things to happen. But the true sort of strategy, or what I like to call strategic mindfulness, is noticing when a small good thing is starting to happen and leaning more into that so that it becomes a big good thing later, rather than waiting on the lottery, basically, to happen before you make your mind up for something. Because every day there are these beautiful things that are happening with your readers, with your book, with your career, with the landscape, that if you pay attention to it and cultivate a little bit more, it turns into big things down the road.
I totally agree with you. I mean, as in just over 5 years ago, I didn't have a website, I didn't have any books, you know, I didn't have a podcast, I hadn't met amazing people like you. And 5 years ago, did you have Productive Flourishing?
I did have it 5 years ago, but I, you know, I live in Portland now, and there are some days I wake up and I'm, you know, sitting on my front porch when the sun's actually out and I'm drinking coffee, and it's like, five, six, 7 years ago, I could not have imagined the world that I live in today.
Yeah.
It wasn't even on the radar. I mean, and not even at the detail level, at sort of the sort of wide life, the level of friends that I have, the community, you know, the amazing opportunities. I couldn't have imagined that. And it was just sort of a daily falling into it back. It was like, oh, this is good. This is good.
Yeah.
And so, you know, some people ask me, like, when I started Productive Flourishing, like, there's this myth that people have about entrepreneurship that's like, you hated your job, and so you hated your job, so you started another thing. So actually, I didn't hate my jobs. Like, I just went with the better. I went where the flow was. There was more joy, more profit, and more service here, and I kept doing that. And so I got out of academia. I got out of the military, you know, slowly. And so, you know, if I keep doing that, then I figure things are going to keep working out. So, but yeah, you're absolutely right. I couldn't imagine being here. And I, with that same sense, I'm like, as much as I'm a strategist, I have to sort of accept that there's the world that I see, and there's the world that I influence, and there's the nexus of possibilities that are in front of us. And that's as far as I can see.
Yeah.
Outside of that, it's providence or the universe, whatever you want to call it. Like, and you have to understand that. And so that's the sort of schizophrenia that you have to have as a good adaptive strategist, is you make a plan. And you know that at a certain point, that plan is not going to reflect reality whatsoever. So you have to make another plan and go forward. But that's it. I mean, I think that's the human condition in a nutshell.
Yeah, and it's very exciting. I get very excited about this. I call it the Olympics. So, you know, the Olympics come up every 4 years, and the difference between how your life is between Olympics, you know, a lot of the times 1 year doesn't make that much difference, but 4 years, it's amazing. So I always remind people of that. But I wanted to ask just last question before we finish up. Your book, you talk about the stages of the business life cycle, and it's when I was reading it, I feel like the indie author, the self-publishing movement is moving out as a whole, is moving out of this aspirational phase, as you call it, to an entry stage where, you know, we're really at the beginning of what's happening and we need to kind of grow. I wonder if you had any thoughts on, you know, this kind of how your business model would apply to self-publishing and how we would move in, you know, into the entry and then onwards so we can do this properly.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to say the thing that a lot of authors don't want me to say on this one.
Go for it.
Is when you move from an aspirational stage to the entry stage and into the growth stage, it's an evolution away from creating a product to creating a business. And so if we want to look at it as an industry, it's creating a business landscape. Basically, as indie authors, we're going to have to redo the distribution channels that the big houses have so that we can actually sell books in a way that allows us to put food on the table, which means several things. We ourselves are going to have to run better businesses. I think we're going to see an increased trend in companies that basically have 3 to 4 people. You've got your writer, you've got your business manager, you've got your marketer, right? You know, so you got those little businesses, and we're going to be little mini publishing houses, which means you have to be able to sell enough books or enough product or enough revenue. You have to bring in enough revenue to employ those people. So that's one thing. But I think it's also thinking about collectively, how are we going to build an ecosystem to where independent authors can thrive so that I'm recommending your books, you're recommending my books, and we're doing more than just the self-promotion. We're doing the promotion not only of our book, but of other people's books, but of the movement itself, right? Because we live, there's been no, you know, bigger cultural sort of disruption than what we live in than the time of Gutenberg, really, when it comes down to it. And so Gutenberg made publishing available for a few. The internet has made publishing available for basically anyone with an internet access, right? And just as Gutenberg changed the landscape of Europe, this is changing the landscape of the world. But we have to think about our role in that ecosystem, both as people that are taking some value from the ecosystem by the time that people buy, you know, buy our books and so on and so forth, but also how we are setting up those relationships, setting it up, because we as a collective can put a lot of pressure on, say, Barnes & Nobles and Amazon and things like that. And I'm already seeing from my side, and you work with more authors, but the publishing houses for around 2008 to 2010 or so, you know, advances went down. They weren't really as, you know, there's a disruption that happened in that industry. But now they come around because so many authors have went to do independent publishing that now they're like, oh, crap, we're actually going to have to, like, be better partners to get them in there, because authors are showing up and saying, really, why should I partner with you versus I want to publish a book and need you? There's a big difference there that happens. But again, I think it comes down to building not just a thriving business of yourself, but a thriving industry that's viable for all people, which means we got to let go of a lot of ego, right? We got to let go of a lot of the idea that I'm winning as opposed to we're all winning. And doing this over the course of 5, 10, 15 years and really building up an industry. And that's one of the reasons that I love what you're doing, Joanna, right? Because it's creating these relationships and these ecosystems that allow us all to rise. So I think that's what we have to do as an industry, is focus on our own businesses, but also on the business of creating an ecosystem of thriving businesses.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Brilliant. It's been amazing to talk to you, Charlie. Tell us where your site is and what people can find there.
Alrighty, so you can find me at productiveflourishing.com. You can also find me on Twitter, but Productive Flourishing is better. And what I do is I create a lot of aids and action guides that really help you take action and focus on the stuff that matters. And so whether it's worksheets or whether it's books or whether it's planners or whether it's small courses that help you do things like project planning, that's what we do there. So our big thing at Productive Flourishing is not necessarily focusing on giving you more information, but giving you more information for action. Because a lot of times the difference between where you are and where you want to be is smart button seat time. Not just button seat time, but smart button seat time. And so that's what we help people do.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Charlie. That was brilliant.
Thanks for having me, John. And let's do it again.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.